So here's, this is my favorite. This is not, in fact, Geoffrey Chaucer. I have to update the slide, right? This was once attributed to Geoffrey Chaucer, treatise on the astrolabe. So this is 14th century. And we've got this, and we're now going to do, this is a little bit of encrypted stuff using some random symbols that the author wrote up. And we're going to decrypt it exactly the way, or somewhat the way we just saw, except this cipher is a little more complicated than the last one. Okay, so this, we're not going to be talking about substitution ciphers, which are the same ones that appear in Poe's The Gold Bug and various other things, where you substitute one letter for another, but not necessarily, you know, just in that sort of cyclical pattern, right? You just have the 26 letters and you have 26 other symbols, and there's some permutation where each letter corresponds to one symbol and vice versa. Okay, so these codes are not that hard to crack if you've got enough text to work with. And even though this isn't very much text, it's going to turn out we can crack it. So how do you crack it by frequency analysis? You look and see where the most frequent letters are. So if you're going to exploit the fact that in ordinary English, the letters appear in very disproportionate frequencies. There are more E's than anything else. There are more T's than, T is number 2, A is number 3, and so on and so forth. Same thing we saw earlier when we were talking about Morse codes and entropy calculation. This is the actual distribution of letter frequencies. So there's a kind of distinctive pattern here. And if you can find, if you can inventory the symbols in your text and assume that the more frequently occurring letters are the symbols are correspond to the more frequently occurring letters, you may be able to make some progress towards decrypting. And that's exactly what we can do in this case. So if we start off with these letters and we find that the most frequently occurring letter in this thing is this thing that looks like an O, but is not going to turn out to be an O. All right, I put little red dots underneath them. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's 12 of those little O symbols. That's more of anything else. So we're going to assume that the O is probably an E, right? Okay, so if we call that an E, and then we look at what the next most frequently occurring letter is, it's this U-shaped thing. There are a bunch of those. That's probably T. Then we're going to, now we're going to do something. So far we were just lucky. Obviously, with so few letters, those two could have been reversed, or it could have been something else, or this could have been a novel by George Perec and there were no E's in it at all. But, you know, let's assume that this is ordinary English. Now you can use a little more intelligence here. So here's a three-symbol word. It looks like spaces. We're going to assume that the spaces really are spaces between words. So here's a three-symbol word, and with the first letter is T and the last letter is E, and there's the same three-letter word with the first letter is T, the last letter is C. So this thing is probably an H. Okay, so you put H's everywhere else, and now you've got this thing that's got that other symbol there is the next letter after a T. That's probably O. All right, so we fill in O's, all the places those occur. And now you've got at the top there, you've got TH something something. There's only a couple of English words that begin that way. What are they? Four-letter words beginning with TH. This and that.
Can't be that
if the letters are all different because the last letter isn't a T, so we're going to assume that that's an I and an S. And, you know, now the thing begins to fill itself out. This thing must be an R either, right? And this is O something. That's probably an N. And, you know, you wind up with this table serveth for to enter into the table of equation of the moan on either side. Okay, so it's Middle English. We wouldn't get it exactly here. But so frequency analysis as a way of decrypting substitution ciphers has been known for a long time. But just to get our terminology straight, the original message is called the plain text. The encrypted version is called the ciphertext. And you can use frequency analysis to crack them. And that's been known at least since, I think it's about the 7th century, as I recall. Okay, so here's our model for a crypto system. We're going to see this over and over again today and later on. You've got someone who wants to send a message. This is Caesar, let's say, and he's sending a message to his generals in the field, retreat at dawn. The message is called the plain text. He uses some kind of key to encrypt it, which you imagine it's like putting it in a box and locking it. The key for Caesar would be shift by 3. The key for the substitution cipher, you'd actually have to have the whole list of 26 letters so you know which ones correspond to which others. That's encrypting it. And then you can send the ciphertext, and the point is that the ciphertext may be public. Maybe you try to keep it private, but you want, the whole point of this is to, you know, if you could really be sure that the ciphertext would arrive at the receiver without anybody seeing it, then, you know, you wouldn't need to encrypt it because you could use whatever technology or armies or whatever it was you were using to protect it, to protect the plain text. So you send the ciphertext, which you might as well imagine could become public. And when the receiver receives it, he takes the same key and decrypts the ciphertext to produce the original plain text. That's the sort of model that we have for how this thing works. And what we want is to make sure that if there's an attacker, the attacker can't decrypt it. And we customarily call, in the cryptography literature, the sender Alice, the receiver Bob. This is very convenient because then you can use the letters A and B for referring to them, and you can also use the different gendered pronouns in English so you don't have to keep referring to them by name. You know, when Alice sends the message to Bob, she does X, and you know who that's referring to. And the attacker, because women always get stuck with these roles, is Eve. I'm sorry I didn't change the color on her name here, but Eve is the eavesdropper who is eavesdropping on the message. Okay, so we got Alice and Bob. Alice sends a message to Bob. Eve is listening in, may get the ciphertext, and we want to make it hard for Eve to decrypt it. So here we go. This is what I was thinking of. We've known since the 9th century when Al-Kindi published his manuscript on deciphering cryptographic message. This was a scholar in Baghdad, where a lot of Western civilization, in particularly in mathematics, was kept alive during the Dark Ages in Europe. But he actually published it. Okay, so in the modern sense, from that point on, anybody who used a substitution cipher for encrypting their messages should have known that they could be cracked. But here we are, how much later? 850 or something like that to 1580, 700 plus years later. Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots, lost her head. Anybody know this story? You all read the story. Anyway, it's in the code book. So she was imprisoned by Elizabeth, and she was smuggling messages out. There was a little scam going on. Someone was actually reading the messages. They were able to decrypt them because she was using a substitution cipher, and the code breakers, which were now by this time a standard part of the arsenal of every European ruler, and I probably rulers all over the world, figured out that she was using a substitution cipher and figured out how to decrypt it. Maybe elaborated a little bit more. There were some symbols for individual words instead of just for individual letters and so on, but essentially a substitution cipher. So, you know, one of the morals here is that just because something is known doesn't mean that people will stop using it. Just because something is known to be insecure a method is known to be insecure does not mean that people will stop using it. Here's another Russian one from the 18th century. And this is my favorite example. This is mafioso Bernardo Provenzano. He's captured in 2006. What?
Il Trattore.
Il Trattore? What does that mean?
He used the tractor because he mowed down his opposition.
Anyway, he moved frequently, almost constantly over the years. For about 40 years, he was on the run, maintaining contact with his underlings through the use of scribbled notes. Reached a place. This guy is actually from the town of Corleone, actually, in Sicily. When these notes fell into the hands of the government officials, guess what he was using? This is a quote from an article about it. He was using the Binu code, assigns a number in order to each letter in the Italian alphabet and adds 3 to that number in ciphertext so that A is 4, B is 5, and so on. He was exactly using the same method that Suetonius had used 2 millennia earlier, not recognizing apparently how insecure the code actually was.